Lisboa, Bruxelles, Berlin, Warsaw.
This podcast has been produced in cooperation with Euronet Plus, the leading radio network for EU news.
But this podcast would not be possible without the incredibly generous support of our amazing listeners who donate a little bit each month at patreon.com/Europeans podcast.
Hello and welcome to the Europeans. My name is Katie Lee. Did I do that right?
That's right. Well done, Katie.
Yay. Dominic gave me some feedback the other day, listeners. He told me that he feels like he has to say my name for me too often and that it's very lazy of me and he resents it. So I'm acting on that feedback this week. My name is Katie Lee. I'm a journalist based in Paris. That one is Dominic Kramer. He's a singer who lives in Amsterdam. And this is the Europeans. It's a podcast about Europe.
What a fresh start. I love this. To be fair, like, it wasn't really that I resented you not saying your name. It was just that I thought we shouldn't assume that people just know who we are.
We've been here for like 8 years now.
It's true. But some people might be listening for the first time. Some people might have discovered us via our newsletter.
Aha, nice plug. Very smooth. What newsletter, I hear you ask?
Yeah, we've got a newsletter that we launched last week called Good Week, Bad Week. And yeah, it's a really nice addition to listening to this podcast. It kind of expands on some of the things we discussed on the show, and it will also touch on some stories that we haven't had space for on the show. Mm-hmm. So yeah, I really recommend you go and subscribe if you haven't yet.
Yeah, it's a great read. How are you, Dominic? What's been going on in Amsterdam?
I am totally fine. I've been out in the garden planting spring bulbs between bursts of rain.
That's so nice.
I've tried to get about 50 bulbs into my garden. Whoa. And into the bit of public space in front of my house. And it kind of just makes me feel like spring is not so far away, right?
It's going to be a flower explosion in a few months' time.
It really is. How have you been?
Similarly, I've been trying to sort of escape the winter gloom. Maybe did it in slightly less of a wholesome way than you. I did something that really cheered me up because I was feeling a bit bummed out at the end of last week. And I went to the Christmas section in Lidl. And before I get loads of angry emails, no, this podcast is not sponsored by Lidl. And yes, I am aware that they are not a perfect company. But just let me have this one moment. The Christmas corner in Lidl is like a one-stop festive pan-European wonderland. They've got gingerbread. They've got marzipan. They've got little jelly fruit things. I mean, like, you know, around this time of year, people go to Christmas markets to get into the mood for the holidays. Why are they bothering? They can just go to Lidl.
Sure. I'm not sure, like, all the independent market sellers that sell things on the local Christmas markets will be happy with you saying that.
Please do support your independent Christmas market.
But fine. Okay, I'll go and check it out one day.
Oh, it's so great. There's my tip. If you're feeling a bit blue, you don't have to buy anything. You can just go look at the snacks and then leave again.
Just use them. Well, enough talk about Lidl. What have we got coming up in the show today, Katie?
Yeah, it's a topic that is much less festive, but really important that we talk about. The rise of the far right is on our minds here a lot at the Europeans. Mm-hmm. I maybe spend slightly too much of my time thinking about what it might mean if far right parties get into power, as they have already done, in several places in Europe. Particularly, you know, I'm thinking about that a lot as someone who is an immigrant in the country that I live in. I think a lot about what it means that far-right ideas are increasingly getting normalised and incorporated into the policies of more centrist parties who are trying to stop far-right parties from stealing their votes. But something that I've been thinking about more and more is how this shift in our politics affects some of us more than others. And a group that is heavily impacted by this shift in our politics, but don't get talked about very much at all, are Roma people, Europe's biggest ethnic minority. What does the rise in far-right groups across Europe mean for them? Joining us later on will be Angela Kotze, chair of the Romani Studies Programme at Central European University. It's a really, really interesting conversation about what has been changing, but also the problems that have always been there. That is coming up in a bit, but first up, it's Good Week, Bad Week.
Good week, bad week.
Who's had a good week, Dominic?
Well, before I tell you who has had a good week, I should mention that this is the segment of the show that was made in collaboration with our radio partners at Euronet Plus. I'm giving good week to same-sex couples in the European Union after the EU's top court ruled that all EU countries have to recognise same-sex marriages that have taken place in other EU countries, even if same-sex marriage is still illegal in the country.
Amazing news.
Yes.
Okay, so it's about same-sex marriages being recognised across EU borders. Presumably this has happened because somebody brought it to court, right? Like, who was that person?
Yes, this case was brought to the European Union's Court of Justice by a gay Polish couple who had been living in Germany and got married in Berlin in 2018. Things started to get difficult for them when they moved back to their home country a few years later. Mm. When they arrived in Poland, they went to Warsaw's civil registry office to register their marital status, but that registration was declined because in Poland, a marriage is only between a man and a woman. There's actually not even any civil partnership law for same-sex couples in Poland yet. The couple, these two guys, Jakub and Mateusz, bravely decided to go down the years-long process of appealing that decision. Mm. First, taking their case to a Polish regional court in 2020, they claimed that by not recognizing their marital status, the authorities were restricting their freedom of movement, one of the key principles of the European Union. That case was rejected, so they thought, okay, we're going to go the next step, and appealed to Poland's Supreme Administrative Court, who then referred it to the top court of the European Union, the Court of Justice in Luxembourg in 2023. And finally, after all those years have passed, the Court of Justice of the EU made its ruling last week and said that Poland's refusal to register the same-sex marriage was a failure under EU law to respect their private and family life.
This feels really huge. I remember when this news first broke last week, there were people very excitedly tweeting, "This effectively means that same-sex marriage is legal across the EU." From the little that I've read about this since then, am I correct in thinking that isn't the case? This ruling doesn't force a country like Poland to make same-sex legal, does it?
Yeah, it doesn't mean that. EU member states still have the freedom to legislate however they'd like to around who can get married and who can't. Mm. Poland actually has something in its constitution saying that marriage is only between a man and a woman. So actual gay marriage legislation in Poland is very likely quite a long way off.
Mm. But for the couple that brought the case, what does it mean for them? Like, do they get to be treated like any married couple in Poland? Like, have they managed to find a loophole to gaining better rights in a country that is still, like, really very un-gay friendly?
Yeah, that's the big question. And it's not been answered fully yet. It really depends on how the Polish authorities decide to implement this ruling. Mm. The EU court says that the Polish authorities have to recognize their marriage. But the next step requires politicians to get involved. So it's possible that the couple might have to continue fighting in order to get the same rights as a heterosexual married couple. Mm. And those rights shouldn't be downplayed. Marriage is not just this symbolic thing. It also gives you specific rights as a couple around taxation, inheritance, property, or even around your pension. Hospital visitation rights can also be a problem for same-sex couples in countries where there is no civil partnership or marriage rights for us queers. But yet, we don't quite know how it's going to play out in Poland yet.
And what if the Polish government said, like, you would think, or you would hope, like Prime Minister Donald Tusk and his government, they came into power promising that they were going to improve rights for LGBTQ+ people. You would hope they would be fairly sympathetic to this ruling, no?
Yeah, he did come into power promising that life would get better for LGBTQ+ people. But not much has actually happened on that front since he came into power. One thing did improve, that those controversial LGBT-free zones that were established by local authorities during the time of the previous government have now all gone. But actually that happened in the courts, not because of legislation from Tusk's government. Mm-hmm. The government has tried to expand hate speech laws to include sexual orientation as a protected category, but that one got caught up in the Constitutional Court, which ruled that the changes were unconstitutional. There also hasn't yet been the promised movement on civil partnerships, although there is a bill in the works at the moment, a bill that has been watered down, partly because of two small Conservative parties in Tusk's coalition. If that were to pass, it could very well be vetoed by the Conservative president anyway. So things have not been looking very rosy for the Polish LGBTQ plus community, despite a somewhat gay-friendlier government being in power. And therefore, yeah, this ruling is really important. But sorry, your question was, has the Tusk government responded to the ruling? And yes, they have. But first, I'll mention what the deputy chief of the president's office said. He said that Poland will not succumb to the terror of rainbow rulings.
Charming. That bodes well.
Terrifying rainbow rulings, right? But as for Prime Minister Donald Tusk's government, they have responded more positively. The Justice Minister said that Poland will have to implement the ruling in some way. And the Secretary of State, who is responsible for LGBT rights, said this is a historic ruling that begins a completely new phase in the legal protection of same-sex couples.
Okay, that sounds promising. I mean, this is, after all, a government that was very big on, like, rule of law. We believe in the rule of law. So you would hope they will actually do what they say.
Yeah, you would hope so. We'll just have to wait and see how it pans out and exactly how far they go with the implementation of this ruling. Of course, if Poland weren't to abide by this ruling, the European Court of Justice can impose ongoing fines until it does implement it properly. So, yeah, this isn't just a symbolic ruling.
And does this ruling mean that loads of same-sex couples living in countries like Poland, where it's not legal, are going to start traveling abroad to get married so that they can then go home and have that marriage recognized in their home country?
Yeah, that's something I was wondering too, whether there will suddenly be a big, huge boom in what people refer to sometimes as marriage tourism for the gays. And I saw a piece of analysis in the Irish outlet RTE that suggested the ruling had been worded in a way that could rule out the possibility of that happening. That journalist said that the ruling seemed to limit the rights to same-sex couples who were actually living in another country when they got married, as opposed to just hopping across the border to take advantage of same-sex marriage rights and then coming back. I wanted to know more about how this could actually play out, so I got in touch with friend of the pod, research coordinator at Democracy Reporting International, Jakub Jaroszewski, our go-to person for whenever we have a complicated legal question about Poland and the EU. And he started with saying, so, as usual with law, it's complicated and it depends.
Great summary. Why can't it just be straightforward and easy?
Oh, I know. But thank goodness there are people like Jakub who can help us understand what's actually going on. He said the court ruled in a specific case of a couple who resided in Germany and were registered there. The court did not say anything about a different situation, for example, if non-residents would conduct a marriage abroad. So yeah, we may have to wait until another couple who are in a different situation, maybe some people in a more marriage tourism situation, take the authorities to court again. I was speaking to producer Wojciech about this marriage tourism thing, and he said that he does know gay married couples in Poland, and they all went abroad to make it happen to places like Copenhagen and Amsterdam. He didn't know, like, on what scale this has been happening, but he certainly knows people who've done it. And for people like that, this ruling probably does feel like a glimmer of hope, even if it doesn't necessarily automatically apply to them. If a marriage tourism case would come to court, it's perfectly possible that in that case, the court would once again rule in favor of protecting the rights to family and the rights to freedom of movement for the same-sex couples again. And Jakub suggested to me that if that happened, he believed that the Court of Justice would probably rule in favor of the same-sex couple again.
Okay, that's good. Although, yeah, we'll have to see how things shake out. So far, you've been talking pretty exclusively about Poland, but of course, that's not the only country within the EU that doesn't recognize gay marriage. So presumably, if this is like an EU court ruling, it could have implications in other countries too, right?
Yes, you're absolutely right. Yeah, and it's worth saying that same-sex marriage is pretty widespread in the west of the European Union, but in the east of the European Union, not so much. Only two European Union states on the eastern side of the bloc offer marriage for same-sex couples. Do you know which two they are, Katie?
Ooh, way to put me on the spot here. Lithuania? Is that one of them?
No.
Can we not do this?
Your favourite country?
Slovenia.
Yeah. And a very digital country.
Estonia.
Yes. Well done. You got there. There are also quite a few countries who only offer some form of civil partnership for same-sex couples, but not marriage. So places like Czech Republic, Hungary, Italy, Latvia. Mm-hmm. And then there are indeed countries like Poland, Romania, Slovakia, and Bulgaria that don't even offer same-sex civil partnerships. So if a case were to emerge in the courts in one of those countries, they should, in theory, also respect the ruling of the European Court of Justice. This doesn't just apply to Poland. So it's quite a momentous ruling, even if there is a lot of uncertainty around it. And I really wanted to know how this ruling was landing with the LGBTQ plus community in Poland. So producer Wojciech Oleksiak put me in touch with someone called Agata, a 24-year-old who lives in Poland and is one of the many young LGBTQ plus people in Poland who entered adult life with so much uncertainty around the legal status of their relationships. Agata left us a voice memo and said,
"Generalnie cieszę się, że takie decyzje są."
Overall, I'm glad that such decisions are being made at a higher level, although I don't have high hopes attached to this decision, because many times it's turned out that the authorities in Poland are Eurosceptic.
Okazywało się, że władze w Polsce są uniosceptyczne.
And their reaction to EU decisions is usually to try and find a way to bypass them or implement them as late as possible. So this Euroscepticism discourages me, and that applies to many issues.
No, ta uniosceptyka mnie zniechęca.
As for this particular ruling, I'm glad there is at least the necessary minimum. I see it as a kind of opening, but I would like more. I'm glad that at least the EU, if not Poland, provides such things. Although I don't have high hopes for compliance or any real local change because of it. So yeah, I think that sums it up well. Mm. It's a good week for same-sex couples in the EU, even if it is only really a small step towards progress. Who has had a bad week, Katie?
I am staying in my home city of Paris for this week's bad week. And I'm going to say it's been a bad week for the Louvre Museum.
Oh no, they haven't been robbed again, have they?
not at the time of recording, no. There hasn't been another heist this week, don't worry. I'm giving bad week to the Louvre's new ticket policy. And that is because the museum has just announced a new pricing system that is essentially going to discriminate against non-Europeans.
Oh.
So from January onwards, if you are not from somewhere within the EU or from Iceland, Norway or Liechtenstein, it will be more expensive for you to visit the Louvre than people from those European countries. One price for the Europeans, one price for the rest of the world.
Oh, I don't know what I make of that. Mm-hmm. I mean, in general, I think our museums and art and culture in general should be as accessible and as affordable as possible.
Right.
Slight tangent, but like one of the things that makes me most proud to be British is the policy of free entry to permanent collections in national museums in the UK.
Yeah, it's amazing.
It really is amazing, even though there aren't many other amazing things about British arts and culture funding. But back to the Louvre, how much difference are we talking about? Is it like just a symbolic thing? Like a euro or something?
No, it's actually quite a big difference in ticket price. It's 10 euros extra.
Ooh.
So Europeans from the countries I just mentioned will continue to pay 22 euros to get in. Residents of those countries too, regardless of what nationality they have. I did actually double check that with the Louvre press office because there's been some conflicting things written in media reports. But yeah, everybody else will have to pay 32 euros. It's a lot.
That is a lot. Is this quite a common thing? Like, or is it totally a new idea to give cheaper tickets to EU citizens. Are there other European museums doing the same thing?
I mean, as far as I can work out, no, it's not a common thing. Like, I haven't been able to find a single major European museum doing this outside France. And please do write in if you do know of another museum that does this that I managed to miss somehow. In New York, the Met has a super local version of this in that if you're a New York resident, you can go for free or just give a small donation. Everybody else has to pay. In Italy, state museums like the Uffizi Gallery in Florence give a little discount to young Europeans aged 18 to 25, like a €2 discount. And there's free entry for under 18-year-olds, regardless of where you're from in the world. But this does seem to be a French thing and a pretty new thing. There's actually a couple of other museums that are going to similarly start charging higher ticket prices if you're not from the EU, Iceland, Norway, or Liechtenstein. And by the way, that is an official club of countries. It's called the European Economic Area, the EEA.
Oh, that thing.
Those countries aren't just like random additions. Go Liechtenstein. So the Palace of Versailles is going to start charging €3 extra to people from outside the EEA as of January. It's not as much of a price difference as the Louvre, so maybe it's not as controversial. And the Château de Chambord, which is this very fancy castle in the middle of France, they are going to start charging €11 extra to non-Europeans. So again, it's quite a hefty chunk of money.
And presumably they're doing this because they think it will bring in more money.
Indeed, yeah. So the Louvre estimates that it can make 15 to 20 million euros extra a year with this new strategy. Yeah, it's a lot. And presumably it is doing this based on market research. This is the most visited museum in the entire world. 8.7 million people visited it last year. And foreigners made up about 70% of the total. Of those foreigners, Americans made up easily the biggest group, 13% of the total, followed by Chinese visitors at 6%. And my assumption is that their thinking is, Chinese and American tourists, they've come all this way. Most of them will quite happily pay €32 to see the Mona Lisa and, of course, the many other treasures that are in the Louvre. The exchange rate between the euro and the dollar in particular tends to leave American visitors to Paris feeling like their money goes quite a long way here. So yeah, I guess the Louvre has just been thinking, can we come up with a way of charging Americans more money in a way that doesn't also put off European visitors for whom €32 can feel like quite a lot of money? And this is the solution that they've come up with.
But I mean, it is also kind of some form of discrimination.
Yeah.
I don't know how I'd feel if I was a tourist coming from the US or South Africa or the UK, mm-hmm. and I saw that it cost me more to get in because of my nationality.
Yeah, I also wonder how those visitors are going to feel about it. And so do the trade unions who represent staff at the museum, by the way. They have come out and said, we do not agree with this decision. They feel like it will be experienced as discrimination. The CFDT union also made a really good point, which is that the Louvre is, like many Western museums, absolutely packed to the roof with treasures that have come from other parts of the world. So you're going to have this situation where visitors from the Middle East are going to have to pay more than Europeans to see works of art from their own countries.
Mm.
There is something quite gross about that. But evidently the Louvre have decided that even if there might be a bit of a backlash, it's worth it because they really need the money.
Yeah, I wanted to ask, how badly do they need the money? Like, how broke is the Louvre? I mean, that jewellery that got stolen was worth quite a bit, I guess.
It was worth just a little bit of money, yeah. The jewellery that got stolen in the jaw-dropping robbery of the Louvre in October was worth €88 million. But I mean, the historical value, like, there is no putting a price on that. So raising the price of the tickets, this is not about trying to raise enough money to buy something else pretty to put in the empty cabinets. And they did already indicate earlier in the year that ticket prices were going to go up before the heist. This is about trying to pay for improvements at the Louvre that are long overdue. There's obviously been a lot of soul searching since the heist about how it was possible for these four guys to rob the Louvre, the pride of France, in 7 minutes flat by posing as construction workers. And as we now know, there had been warnings internally about the weak security, particularly in this part of the museum, for years. I mean, across the whole museum, less than 40% of the rooms currently have CCTV. How is that possible? And actually, there was a report released last month by France's top auditing body. The report was written before the heist, but it was painfully scathing about how badly the Louvre has been financially managed. It said the museum had basically spent years prioritizing projects that had seemed, quote, visible and attractive, and basically ignoring the investments in like boring maintenance stuff that really needed to be done. You asked how badly the Louvre needs money. Well, the good news is that according to the auditors, they do have enough money to carry out a bunch of technical improvements that we now know they really, really need to do. So yes, security, but also stuff like improving the aircon, fixing leaks. The auditors estimate that it has enough money to do that stuff. They need about 480 million euros to restore the building.
Wow.
Because it is apparently crumbling. I mean, it does feel like quite an appropriate symbol of French national pride right now, given the state of politics over here. So they can make the fixes that they urgently need to make. Those plan changes were actually already part of a big sweeping plan to renovate the Louvre that was announced by Emmanuel Macron months before the robbery, back in January. So they'd been already kind of planning to fix the place up, but they actually want to do much more ambitious stuff to the building than that. The big thing that they want to do is build a fancy new space just for the Mona Lisa, which will allow for much better crowd control. I don't know, when did you last go to the Louvre? Have you been to see the Mona Lisa?
Yeah, I think not since I was like 16.
Do you remember what it was like?
I remember it being very far away and not really being able to get anywhere near it.
Yeah.
Because there were too many people there.
Yeah, and that was pre-smartphone, I guess, Dominic, because you're so old.
Thank you.
Well, if you imagine what it's like today, I mean, like, it's like 1,000 times worse, right? There are just these huge crowds of people holding their phones in the air, trying to take really disappointing, blurry pictures of this painting. Like, it's not really a moment of contemplating the beauty of this masterpiece. So yeah, that's a big part of this big, ambitious plan. Change the building, give the Mona Lisa a separate space just for her. But that involves major, major changes. And according to the auditors, they really don't have the money for that. All of that extra construction is going to cost another estimated 666 million euros. And the auditors basically said that this big splashy plan had been announced without anyone really knowing where this money is supposed to come from. So in answer to your question, yes, they are quite short of cash. They are going to need to get hundreds of millions of euros from somewhere. Now, the Louvre already took $1 billion from the United Arab Emirates government back in 2007 to open a branch of the Louvre in Abu Dhabi. That was quite a controversial deal. I don't think they can expect much more cash from the French government right now because I don't know if you've noticed, but the French government is broke and cannot agree on a budget. So I guess the museum is looking for fresh ideas. Hence, charging non-Europeans more money to come and look at stuff. And I think it's a shame. Like, I would love to know to what extent they considered raising the prices by less, but for everyone. I mean, like, evidently there must have been a reason that they decided not to do that. But it does feel like a shame that the new policy involves, yeah, like discriminating on the grounds of nationality. Museums talk all the time about democratizing access to art and this doesn't feel democratic, you know, even in the way that it defines who gets to be a European or not. Like, lots of people are being excluded from this. It's like, people from the Balkans, please pay 32 euros. People from the UK, please pay 32 euros. People from Switzerland. I mean, maybe it's okay to charge people from Switzerland 32 euros.
Yeah, I agree.
It's a very rich country. Am I allowed to say that?
You are. Yeah, it does kind of feel like a political move in a way from the Louvre. It's just like maybe they're thinking what's going to play well with the French public, what's going to like play into this political moment as well, where like fear of the other is like the biggest political capital and the biggest political trend. So I wonder whether that's like part of why they made this decision.
Or maybe they've been bribed by the EU to do this so that this becomes one of those things that you think about as a real benefit of EU membership. Like, well, I've got no roaming on my phone and I can get into the Louvre on the cheap.
Yeah, it was all Ursula von der Leyen's idea. Good conspiracy theory. Anyway, in the meantime, is there really still no sign of the stolen jewellery? Like, I thought they arrested some people.
It's amazing, isn't it? Yeah, they have arrested several people. Our local newspaper, Le Parisien, seems to have pretty good sources inside the investigation. And they have reported that two out of the four men who are accused of being the actual robbers, Two of them have admitted that they carried out the heist, but they've said that they were just carrying out orders. This was a contract job. They weren't the masterminds. They were offered 15,000 euros to carry out a heist that had been planned by someone else. And that kind of makes sense, right? Because there were some things about this burglary that were really quite ingenious. Like, they were dressed up as construction workers because no one even looks twice at construction workers. You just kind of assume they are where they're supposed to be. The way that they targeted this window that was pretty easy to break into and was really badly covered by CCTV. The investigators have said that a lot of the planning seems to have been quite meticulous. There were, for example, lots of different burner phones used at different points in the planning, and the planning itself seems to have taken weeks on end. At the same time, even though these four guys did manage to carry out the burglary, there are certain aspects of it that from the beginning seemed like really weirdly amateur. Like, they left a bunch of DNA at the scene. They dropped a crown while running away. And the profile of the suspects is reportedly more that of small-time criminals than like heist geniuses. So the investigators are quite seriously considering this idea that it might indeed have been planned by some like high-level, clever criminals and then subcontracted out to four random guys. But as you say, like, there is no sign of the jewels, which is, of course, really frustrating for the 100 or so investigators that are reportedly working on trying to find them. Apparently, the two suspects who are talking, they're not really saying much at all, apart from we were just following orders. They haven't said anything about whose orders they were following. As soon as the heist happened, a lot of experts said that the thieves were almost definitely planning to break the jewels up and sell the gems individually. Because no one is going to want to buy these things as they are. They are way too recognizable. And supposedly there are specialist art police watching the international black market for anything that looks like the diamonds or the sapphires that might have come off the royal tiara, for example. But they haven't seen anything yet. That's a really nice earring you're wearing, by the way. Is that new?
Oh, what, this sapphire? Just a coincidence. Okay, time to get serious and talk about our own financial woes, moving on from the Louvres. This podcast really depends on donations in order to survive. I hope you enjoy our episodes, and maybe you even think our episodes are important for a diverse and functioning European democratic sphere. If that's the case, then please consider heading to patreon.com/Europeans podcast. You can give us as little as €3 per month. You can pay for a whole year in advance with a small discount if that feels better to you. Anything you can afford, we'd be so grateful.
Several amazing people did this over the past week. They are Daniela, Jedediah, Ryan, Tim, Christoph, Pavel, and Emanuele. Thank you all so, so much. And if you're thinking about becoming a supporter of the Europeans, a little incentive to do that this week is our upcoming live Christmas episode recording. We do this every year on Zoom, just with supporters of the podcast. It's the last show of the year. It's really fun and festive. Everyone brings snacks. It's a little bit interactive. You get to hear all the bloopers. And there's a Q&A with us at the end. This year, we are doing this recording on the evening of the 15th of December, starting at 8:30 Central European time. So if you'd like to join, do sign up to support the show.
If you can't afford it right now, please consider instead telling a few people about the show, because that's the next best thing you can do to help keep us up and running, either in person or on social media. Thank you so much to everyone who is helping us out in whatever way they can. Now it's time for the interview segment of the show. And for that, we're joined by producer Katz Laszlo. Hi, Katz.
Hi, Katz.
Nice to see you from across the city.
Hello.
As Katie said last week, we've realized that we haven't talked nearly enough on this show about Roma people over the many years of making this podcast. There are thought to be somewhere between 10 and 12 million Roma people living in Europe, about 6 million of them in the EU. And according to a 2020 report from the European Union Agency for Fundamental Rights, Roma communities continue to face excessive force, police brutality, as well as widespread poverty, inadequate living conditions, exclusion from the labour market, and harassment. So it's really important that we do talk about them more. And yeah, that's why we're here today, isn't it, Kat?
Absolutely. There's a lot for us to learn still. I feel like the presence of Roma people and like Roma culture, how people talk about it, is quite varied per country. Like growing up in Spain, I immediately think about flamenco, but that's so region specific. And there's just so much more I would like to learn about Roma culture. But as Dominic said, we are starting to make up for our underrepresentation of issues facing Roma people. And we're using our interview segment this week to speak with leading expert on Romani studies, Angela Kotze, who is a sociologist and the chair of the Romani Studies program at the Central European University.
Yeah, we wanted to speak to Angela after our producer Morgan Childs spotted a piece she'd written a few months ago on Verfassung's blog about a new piece of legislation in Hungary that's being viewed as anti-Roma. It's a law that emerged following a controversial Hungarian constitutional amendment that we've actually discussed on the show before. You may remember it. It was this amendment that declared that there are only two genders. It introduced a blanket ban on drug use and created a basis for banning pride marches under the pretense of the so-called protection of children. But one part of the amendment that didn't get quite as much attention as the pride ban was a new local identity clause. And to quote Angela, this creates a legalized mechanism for racial exclusion, especially targeting Roma citizens. It gives municipalities the power to decide who belongs in their community. So that was the constitutional amendment. And now additionally, we have this new piece of legislation, the Act on the Protection of Local Identity in Hungary, something which has been described by the European Roma Rights Centre as creating apartheid by stealth. I'll let Angela explain the details, but as you'll hear in our conversation, the persecution of Roma people is by no means unique to Hungary.
No, sadly not at all. It has a long and dark history across Europe. So we decided to call up Angela a few weeks ago.
When I was really sick. Apologies for my very viral sounding voice.
Oh man, I'm not sure I sounded any healthier. It's the season. But yes, we wanted to know what the rise of the far right in Europe means for Roma communities and to talk through some of the frankly pretty horrific anti-Roma practices that have persisted, unfortunately, for decades.
Hi, Angela. Thanks so much for joining us today.
Yes, thanks for being here.
Hi, I'm glad to be here. Thanks for the invitation.
You recently wrote a piece for Verfassung's blog about Hungary's new law on the protection of local identity. Can you explain what that law is and what its intent was for Hungarian municipalities?
Yeah. So basically, this law has been adopted in 2025, July. It's called Act on the Protection of Local Identity. And somehow it's really straightforward because it normalizes racial exclusion at the local level under the guise of safeguarding heritage, community values, and community identity. And basically, very directly empowers local community leaders to exclude people whom they don't want to see in their localities. But of course, they are not using the language of excluding certain people. Rather, it's like sugarcoating. It's a language of organic development. We are protecting community values. We are preserving a tradition. And of course, there's a really strong intention behind that, to get rid of people whom they don't want to live together. So it's quite easy. And there is an interesting connection that before the law, this new law has been adopted in July. In April, Hungary re-amended the constitutional clause on local identity. And while critics were quick and absolutely right to raise concern about several provisions of Hungary, such as the declaration that there are only two genders, the blanket ban on the drug use, and the subordination of freedom of assembly to child protection, the amendments most tolerated the exclusion has drawn far less attention. The new local identity clause, which basically empowers municipalities to decide that who belong to their communities and who should not belong. And I think that's really important because basically the constitutional law, it gave a green light to adopt this new legislation on the Act on the Protection of Local Identity.
Mm-hmm. I mean, so far we've been talking about Hungary, but this isn't just a Hungarian issue, right? As you point out in that piece. What has your experience been like watching the far right come to power across Europe as someone who's devoted her life to the study of Romani history and Romani rights?
Actually, I mean, as I pointed out in the article as well, that this is not the East European issue. We see it across Europe. I think one of the techniques which is used by the extreme right to stigmatize, criminalize, racialize Roma and to show them that basically they are a threat on the local population. Like particularly if we think about the EU accession before 2004, the eastward enlargement, many Western European countries actually were thinking about Roma as people who will come and will take an advantage of the welfare system, who's going to invade us. There are many articles which show that, like British tabloids, actually. So the criminalization and the racialization become really solidified in various European countries. And I'm referring to the case in Italy in 2007, when basically there was a sensationalist media and the racialized murder case. And it was a kind of turning point for Roma and Sinti in Italy. The authorities, both central, local, developed some kind of security measures against Roma. It was called, in a quotation mark, Roma menace. And basically, the populist approach really demonized Roma communities and did a very little to address the real issues of integration or inclusion of Romani people, some of whom had lived in Italy for decades. And the security perspective, actually, which is one of the characteristic, not just in Italy, but many other European countries as well, which basically somehow used against Roma. And in Italy, they declared the state of emergency first in May 2008. In France, Nicolas Sarkozy government in 2010 launched a securitized campaign linking Roma and travelers to crime and social order, disorder, framing them as a kind of, you know, threat to the nation. The decision was that they're going to repatriate more than 1,000 Roma who've been an EU citizens originally. They were coming from Bulgaria and Romania, and they start to send them back by plane. So I think it's quite outrageous, and the European Parliament passed a resolution calling for a moratorium on the mass expulsion of Roma people from France. Anyway, I don't want to go into the details, but I just wanted to illustrate that this is not an Eastern European issue. Rather, it's very much imbricated in our societies in Western Europe as well.
Mm. As you've already made very clear, discrimination of Roma people is coming from a lot of different angles. There have been many documented cases of forcible sterilization of Roma women. And I'd like to ask you about the position of those women now. But first, can you explain a bit about that practice and how it's affected so many women on our continent?
Yeah. Sterilization, and particularly forced sterilization, it happened in Czechia and Slovakia, Czechoslovakia, particularly in the 1960s and 70s. And somehow it was very much common in those countries that if girls are too young, too poor, and plus they are Roma, it would be good to sterilize them, right? And they know better than the patients what they should do. And particularly in Czechoslovakia, legislation was issued in 1970s, which basically allowed doctors to sterilize Romani women who were deemed too prone to criminality, antisocial behavior, imbecility, alcoholism, and other conditions. And of course, we have to know that this kind of diagnosis were made by the local healthcare workers, doctors and social workers, right? So they had the power to decide who are the one who needs to be sterilized, whose children are unworthy. And sometimes they were misled by local doctors that this can be reversed. And almost always, they never even consented to have that kind of sterilization because they just didn't understand this very medical, technical language. So basically, this kind of dehumanization and inferiorization continued even after 1989 as a social practice.
Yeah, in the Czech Republic, thousands of women are currently applying for compensation after having been sterilized, some of them as recently as 2008 or 2009, which is impossible. I can't believe that it's that recent. Is the visibility of their struggle improving the public's awareness of and support for their cause, do you think? Or is the fact that it's taken so many decades to redress these violations and that the compensation is happening so slowly yet another sign that Europe is turning its back on its own citizens?
Certainly, there is some kinds of recognition. You know, law can be a friend as an ally, right? Because it gave some kind of visibility in Europe and in Czech Republic, and visibility not just by the legislation, by civic organization, but the compensation is really going very slow. And in fact, some of the women are still not compensated. Some of them died. And certainly we know that the money, the financial compensation, won't really reestablish the dignity which had been violated and terrorized in this horrible time. And in Slovakia, for example, still there is no any kinds of bill, no legislation. And Slovakia's Ministry of Justice just told that they are intended to draft a compensation law by the end of 2025, right? But still, we don't know how it's going to be. And the details has been remained very vague. And we don't know whether this law is going to be enacted or not.
You've described some pretty horrific issues all over the continent, really. And I'm wondering what sort of action you'd like to see at an EU level to protect people of Roma origin on our continent.
I think the EU definitely should rethink their policies and their social inclusion. So it would be really nice if the EU would act preventively and not reactively. But that requires a serious political commitment and financial commitment as well.
Mm. Now, whether that political and financial commitment is coming from the EU, we'll have to wait and see. Mm. You can follow Angela on LinkedIn if you're over there. I'm still resisting the LinkedIn pull, but Katz, you're quite a linkaholic these days, aren't you?
It is actually sort of my favourite social media, to be honest. Like, you learn about all these interesting things. It's much more like content-based, and also the fights don't feel like mean, you know? Like, people get into sort of, they debate about things, but it's not like a character assassination. So I've been enjoying LinkedIn, yes.
Corporate cats.
Well, Angela is someone who definitely makes the case for LinkedIn, because she's one of these people that posts really interesting things there. So have a look at her profile. We'll link to it in the show notes, along with the excellent article she wrote for Verfassung's blog.
It's time to head to the inspiration station. Katz, while we've got you here, I had no fun this week. One of my kids has been sick, so I spent all the time that I would usually spend watching TV clearing up vomit. So I'm going to ask you instead if you've got any recommendations for things to read or things to watch.
Oh, I've got loads, actually. So I had a hard time choosing. But the one that it shook out to be was, so a few weeks ago, actually through this podcast, I was asked to moderate the Polish Film Festival in Amsterdam at the Bali. And as part of that, I got to interview the amazing film director, Anna Jadowska. And it was about her fantastic film that I watched twice within 1 week and loved every bit of it both times. It's called Woman on the Roof. Have you heard of it?
No,
I haven't.
So it actually came out in 2022, so it's been out for a while, and it's based on a true story, which is even more glorious because it's about an older woman who successfully tries to rob her local bank, like on the high street of the place where she lives.
Wow.
And it's a true story.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know which parts are true and which parts are not. It's obviously fictionalized, but there were so many good parts to this film. Like, one of the realizations I had is I almost never see a film where the protagonist is a woman in her 60s or 70s. Like, it just really doesn't happen that much, which is a bit outrageous. It's 2025. But yeah, the film is like packed with these tiny little revolutions, as the main character is this woman who has spent her whole life taking care of other people. And she sort of slowly unravels in this film in the best possible way. And I'm an audio person, so I have no idea how film people do this, but so much of it was communicated without words, and it was just so clever. Mm. It really is one of a kind. I would say go watch it immediately and laugh and cry and think, yeah.
Ah, sounds great. Can't wait to watch that. What's it called again?
Woman on the Roof.
Woman on the Roof.
Sounds wonderful.
Dominic, what about you? What have you been enjoying?
Well, the offering I wanted to bring into the Inspiration Station today is a website that I heard about on Mastodon, thanks to our follower, Borger. It's the website mappingdiversity.eu, and this website maps the diversity of street names in 32 of Europe's major cities.
Okay.
The headline is that 90% of the street names named after individuals are dedicated to white men. This may not surprise you, but it's good to be confronted with these stark figures and to explore the differences from city to city.
Is there a city in Europe that is actually doing better at, like, more diverse representation in street names?
Well, Stockholm, Madrid and Seville are the top three when it comes to female street name representation, but none of them are anywhere near reaching gender equality. Stockholm, the number one in female street name representation, still only has 19.5% of its street names named after women.
Wow.
That's less than a fifth.
Wow.
The website has a lot of interesting articles that you can read, graphics to explore, and yeah, it's a project coordinated by OBC Trans Europa for the European Data Journalism Network, and it's really nicely designed. So go and spend some time there and muse over how the preponderance of men amongst our street names in Europe not only says something about our past, but also speaks to our present and future. It's mappingdiversity.eu.
Really cool.
Fuck. For my happy ending this week, I want to tell you about a huge European study that was published in the journal Nature that has found evidence that multilingualism, so speaking more than one language, seems to protect against accelerated aging.
Oh, cool.
Now, it's a bold claim, but it's a conclusion that they've reached using the data of over 85,000 individuals across 27 European countries.
Wow.
The researchers found that multilingual Europeans were half as likely to experience accelerated aging compared to our monolingual counterparts. Maybe some monolingual people out there are listening to this and panicking and thinking, this is not a happy ending. But just
download,
remember,
Duolingo quick.
Yeah, exactly. It's never too late. Go learn another language. Your brain and body will almost certainly be grateful for it.
We are not here next week. We're taking a week off to plan a heist. This podcast needs funding somehow.
It's true. If you see us near the Rijksmuseum, we are just looking around.
Taking a stroll. No, we're not here because we're planning some podcasts for next year. But if you miss us while we're gone, do please try our brand new newsletter. Lots of people have already signed up. Producer Morgan, who is writing it, has done such a brilliant job so far of capturing the weird and wonderful tone of this podcast while catching you up on some of the stories that we weren't able to talk about in this week's episode. And a new issue drops in your feed tomorrow.
This week's episode was produced by Kat Laszlo and Morgan Childs. Wojciech Oleksiak mixed and mastered the show and also provided editorial support for my Good Week segment. Go and find us on Mastodon, on Blue Sky, on YouTube, and on Instagram. And we'll be back in 2 weeks.
See you then.
Devleza.
Bye.